and welcome to the menu, Monocle's food and drink program. I am Markus Hippi. This week, Australian food culture is rich and varied. We look beyond avocado toast and flat whites to discover the essence of cooking from down under.
The British came, and really for 150 years, the food was essentially the same. It was quite repetitive, but that's not to say there weren't diamonds in the rough.
Then we hop over to Hong Kong to meet a pioneer of Burmese cooking in the city.
The current situation going on in Burma has kind of drawn a clear relationship between food and activism.
We'll also hear a top dinner sounds recommendation and the week's food and drink headlines. That is all ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. Australians abroad and the likes of Donna Hay have done an ace job in creating the idea we have of the country's food. But it shouldn't be forgotten that Australia has a rich and varied culinary history, and what we consider Australian food now has actually been shaped by a multitude of influences from around the world. So Australia may well be famous for its avocado toast and flat whites, but what else should we know about it? Chef and writer Ross Dobson has just released an excellent guide to the food culture down under. It's called Australia the Cookbook, and I spoke to Ross to hear his thoughts about what his home country's food is all about. He began by talking about the oldest known recipes and Aboriginal cooking.
Yeah, well, that was a really tricky thing for me to take on because my scope of knowledge with that was quite limited. I come from a generation, unfortunately, that paid little respect or knowledge of Aboriginal cooking and food and farming techniques. And indeed, it's just been revealed as we open our eyes more and find things like intricate and ancient fish traps that have been around that predate the pyramids, for example. We're finding evidence that grains of grass were grown in southeastern Australia that was used to grind and make bread. Farms were set up in areas that are now Sydney and Melbourne that were specifically harvested to grow yam daisies, which was a root vegetable. But we'd only ever thought that they were, you know, subsistence sort of moving around farmers, if you will, but that's not the case. The struggle for me was to step back from that, and Jody Autra has written an amazing essay on Aboriginal food and Aboriginal ingredients. And I really felt like I had to say that without any doubt, the first people here were Aboriginal Australians. We were the colonisers, if you will. And technology, as it advances, shows that they have been here. You know, we were initially taught 30,000 years, 40,000 years. Now some say it's up to 65,000 years. And with all due respect to the first people, some of them believe they've been here forever. So that's not really taken into account for them. And in a way, whether it's 65,000 or 100,000 years, you know, they really have been here forever. And that was, to me, the first epoch of Australian food. And I don't think you can get that. I know you don't get that anywhere else, that it's the longest ongoing civilization of man. So when you get to the second epoch, and I found, for me, the easiest way to approach the book was to divide it into these three periods. So for time immemorial, the Aboriginals have been here, and then in the blink of an eye, the colonists came, and the period that they were here for, say, 150 to 200 years is the blink of an eye compared to how long the first people were here. And the unique thing about that is they brought with them unique foods, and the assumption was that it could be grown here. So the English, as we all know, settled Australia. Other people came, but no one stayed. The Chinese, they say, had come here and done trade with the first peoples in Northern Territory, which I find fascinating. The Dutch had been to Western Australia, but no one had stayed. And, of course, the British needed somewhere to put the convicts and the criminals, and they're running out of room. So there were two type of people that came to Australia and settled, and that was the British military class and convicts. The convicts were mostly from Ireland. So they brought with them really specific ideas about what to eat and certainly what to grow. And that was a challenge for them. It wasn't you know, they were here in 1788, the first settlement. It wasn't until the 1820s or 1830s where they started to really successfully grow things. But until then, and right up until now, there are a couple of really interesting recipes, like pea and ham soup is hugely popular in Australia. It's one of the biggest soups on local food sites that, you know, I think that without a doubt, this goes back to the rations that both the free settlers and the convicts were given when they came here. There was a lot of salt beef, dried split peas and things like that, obviously because those ingredients travel so well. And they cooked with these things, and to this day, those ingredients are really embedded, I think, in how we cook and what we eat. And as a result, this was really difficult to change. So you had tens of thousands of years of First Peoples being here, then the British came, and really for 150 years, the food was essentially the same. It was quite repetitive, but that's not to say there weren't diamonds in the rough. There's some beautiful examples of baking that came out of Australia during this time, and this need to have what they could eat at home. They, you know, they would crave goose at Christmas time. There were no geese in Australia. Well, there might have been, but not en masse, but there was a lot of lamb. So they cooked something called colonial goose. I'd never heard of it, and I've never heard of a lot of things in working on this book, which was really good because the book was not about me. It was about a collective group of all of us and really trying to cover as many bases as I could. So the colonial goose was fascinating. I'd never heard of it. I tested it, and we shot it for the book. It's absolutely delicious. It's lamb. It's stuffed with things you would stuff goose with at Christmas time, and it works perfectly well.
Ross, I have to ask about the current reputation and the current idea of Australian food people have abroad. When they think of Australia, it's often about sunshine, avocado toast and flat white. When did avocado toast and flat white, for example, enter the Australian culinary culture?
Look, that's a really good question because I've been asked that a few times, and also secondly, I'm like, I think it was one of those things that many of us were eating and it went kind of disregarded. It's like, you know, I overlooked a sausage sandwich or a snag sanger, as we call them in Australia, for the book. And someone picked it up and went, got to have that in there. It's not a recipe per se. The other thing I overlooked was a salad roll. Now, it sounds really weird, but a salad roll in Australia is quite unique. We always have beetroot on it. We always have some sort of cheese. There's even the most bizarre coleslaw, which I was talking about the other day in an interview, which has no cabbage. It's a Broken Hill coleslaw. And it was something my mum fed to me and my siblings, grated carrot and grated cheddar mixed up. I had no idea where she got it from, completely forgot about it until I started researching the book. It was traced back to Broken Hill, which is an outback mining town in New South Wales. So the avocado toast, I remember where we lived in one house, we had avocado trees, and it was the 80s, and it was only obvious that we put it on bread or toast. It was just such an everyday thing. You wouldn't put it in a recipe or publish it. But I think that took maybe 30 years later. Look, I think that phenomenon has got a lot to do with, I'm going to go out on a limb here, inner city young folk or hipsters. Does that make me sound old saying that? Because I think only old people say hipsters. I'm not sure. But about 4 years ago, there was a whole hoo-ha about an investment banker saying if hipsters didn't go out and eat so much avocado on toast, they could afford a mortgage. Look, ridiculous thing to say, but possibly some truth in that, because the cafe culture boomed in Australia starting off in the 2000s. Avocado toast was on the menu. It was a kind of affordable, not so much now. So why would you go and buy an avocado and bread when the bread's going to sit in the fridge and half the avocado is going to go off where you can go to the local cafe? So the combination of the climate, the sunshine, sitting outside on turned upside down milk crates or old chairs before you go to the beach is a stereotype that is pretty accurate. But, you know, we don't frolic on the beach in speedos and bikinis and jump around kangaroos. That's just ridiculous. And some of us wear sunscreen and not all of us love the beach. But and then enter the flat white. I think it does deserve some credit in that, you know, there is, again, this funny rivalry between Australia and New Zealand. You would have heard of it with things like the PAV and even it's come down to the flat white coffee. And, you know, there's a well-founded theory that in the 1950s, which was the third epoch of Australian food, which I already mentioned, the first one being Aboriginal Australians, then 150 years of white Australia policy, which translated into a certain type of food. From the 1950s, we get immigrants from the Mediterranean, especially Italy and Greece. A lot of them settle in the bigger cities where they find work, especially in Melbourne. I mean, to this day, Melbourne has more people who speak Greek outside of Greece. And a lot of Italians went there. In the 50s, they started to import coffee machines, espresso machines, which were unheard of. They started to import coffee beans, and they started to grow garlic, which Australians had loathed up until then. And I would dare say the British as well. You know, it was like something that just was not in our cooking. So the flat white, I remember having my first flat white in probably 1984 or 85 at a cafe in an Italian ghetto, if you will, in Sydney. It was called Bill and Tony's. It was an old terrace house. And they made flat white coffees. You didn't know really what it was. You didn't question it. But it was kind of when you moved out of home and you didn't want to drink your mum's cappuccino anymore with the sweet chocolate on top. And you felt grown up because they made a coffee that was pretty strong, had a kick in it, didn't have the froth or the chocolate, but had that cafe crema from the coffee, but also this creamy milk. So I think the flat white is something that we can say possibly it came from here and it's part of our coffee culture. The avocado on toast, you know, I was talking to an old school friend the other day, and she said, my mum was eating it in 1979. She said, we all thought she was totally weird. And she would have been 12 in 1979, and I wasn't much older. So it is fascinating, isn't it, that we have this, you know, and I've had friends from Britain come here, and they talk about how good the breakfasts are. And I say, well, I think the climate really encourages people to get up early and the sunshine. I mean, I lived in London. I don't want to go and sit in a milk crate at 7 in the morning. You know, the sun's not out and it's not warm. And there's so many reasons why it works. And I think at the same time when this cafe culture was booming, I think Australian publishing was booming from the 2000s. And you mentioned Donna Hay before, and that was when really she hit her strides with all those fresh takes on recipes. But in a way, her recipes and the way it was photographed was very light and bright and fresh. And I'm the last person to big note Aussies. I actually cringe when I hear an Australian accent in an airport. Maybe you do too. I'm not sure. But I think there are some things that Australians have done quite well. And the world of food publishing is one thing that was, you know, really putting it out there.
It's been a great thing for Australia, considering soft power and everything. When people think about Australia, they often think about food nowadays.
Well, that's good, isn't it? I think that the cafe culture, I have to say, I also remember before cafe food, breakfast, brunch culture in Australia, and we don't really use the word brunch. We have like all-day breakfast. I feel like that's a very American thing. But the cafe culture here, it began even before it became something that was acknowledged, even locally and overseas, that people would go and in the late 70s, early 80s, and then be focaccia split open and filled with pickled eggplant and mortadella and provolone and grilled, which is very Italian, I guess. But then a few years later, we kind of moved on from focaccia and we wanted Turkish bread. So we started filling the Turkish bread with the Italian ingredients. And then I think that it was like, well, what can't we do? Why can't we go to the Turkish bakery in inner city Redfern that it makes the most beautiful pide and fill it with feta cheese and basil and Greek ingredients, if you will? Like, I think it was just all about experimenting and trying new things. I think initially without trying to impress anyone except the people in your community. You know, Sydney is very village, community-based. You know, Melbourne is as well. I lived in Sydney for a while. I don't at the moment. But in Melbourne, I've lived there. And, you know, every suburb is, you have your cafe and that's where you go and they do this and they do the best coffee.
Looking at the future of Australian food, in your book, you talk about three periods of Australian food. And you've been talking much about innovation taking place in Australia. I'm wondering, what is bubbling under at the moment? What do you expect from the future?
You know, I think I always hate that question. question. It's a good one. It throws me because I don't really know. I think COVID threw us. I think 2 years ago, there were some really amazing new restaurants pushing the boundaries and cooking only on fire, including even the desserts were cooked over open fire, or a restaurant that was based just on starch, weirdly enough, because it's not that popular, like bread and potatoes and bread from all over the place. I think we've finally gone, okay, you know, we love the Indian food and Middle Eastern food, and Chinese food is almost in our veins because it's in every Australian town. You know, there's a Chinese restaurant. I think it's about sitting down and new young chefs are going, okay, one of my parents, the chances are one of my parents is born overseas, I'm less likely to be influenced by the shackles of tradition, and I'll take on what my parents cook and incorporate with this really fresh new take on ingredients. You know, we're blessed with geography and climate that anything can grow here. But in terms of a cuisine, if I was asked that question 10 years ago, I would have gone, oh, you know, Vietnamese spring rolls and the fresh flavor of Vietnamese and pho soup. And that's become like, there's a franchise here everywhere that just does all that. And I think it's now it's about the new, but I don't know what that is. I'm sorry. But I think really COVID threw everything and there were some really exciting things happening and that just put a nail in things for a bit. But I think things are exciting.
That's great to hear. And also let's remember that the pandemic is not going to last forever. So eventually the borders will open up again and people will start flocking to Australia again. Just finally, Ross, before I let you go, once you start receiving tourists in Australia again, what kind of food should they look for? What do you think they should try over there?
Yeah, look, I would say just we've all learnt from this experience and one way or another. And what I would want to do when I travel again, I can't wait to travel again, but if I was an overseas visitor coming here, I would walk on a beach. It doesn't have to be Bondi. It doesn't have to be St. Kilda or Coogee or any of the beaches we know. Walk on a beach on coastal Australia in a country town, find a milk bar or a fish and chip shop, have a glass of wine and have some local oysters and some beautiful grilled or battered fish and a few of the other little quirky things that are unique here, like hamburger with a lot, which must have beetroot and pineapple, and just chill out and enjoy what would be a combination of the climate, the geography, and the food. I think that would be something I would do, and that's what I would say to people coming here. Enjoy the sun and the water.
Ross Dobson there. He has just released Australia the Cookbook, which is published by Fidon. You are listening to The Menu. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Maylie Evans.
Thanks, Marcus. We begin this week's roundup in New York, where Michelin revealed its stars for the city for 2021. In what has been an extremely difficult year for hospitality in the Big Apple, only 7 new stars were awarded, including Resdora, Stefano Secchi's popular Italian restaurant, and Tsukimi, an East Village Kaiseki restaurant, with 6 of the 7 new choices located in Manhattan. One positive for the city was that no restaurant that remained open or even temporarily closed was downgraded, with judges giving clear leeway considering the testing times. A short hop to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania now, where researchers at the Carnegie Mellon University have made a breakthrough in the science of pasta. Yes, you did hear that right. A team of biological engineers has found a way to create a flat version of the much-loved food that, upon boiling, transforms into traditional pasta shapes like fettuccine. Not only does it reduce cooking times compared to normal dried pasta, but more importantly, it will use less packaging and therefore have a smaller carbon footprint. Next, we're off to Bordeaux, where literally space-aged bottles of Petrus 2000 wine are being sold at Christie's for an expected $1 million per bottle. As covered in this segment a few weeks ago, the bottles were aged aboard the International Space Station, which travels at around 17,500 miles per hour, 250 miles up in the air. A well-regarded bottle of wine anyway, it would have normally retailed for a few thousand dollars. However, sommeliers have commented that the space-aged bottles have developed a different, more evolved taste. The proceeds of the sales will go back into food production experiments in space. Finally, we go to Hong Kong, where special edition food-themed postage stamps have caused quite a debate on which dishes best represent the city. Created to pay homage to the city's iconic snacks, this series includes classics like fish balls, buttered pineapple buns, peanut candy, and steamed rice rolls. Numerous food critics have questioned the choices, with dishes put forward as better representations of the city, including siomai, milk tea, and soybean pudding. That's all for this week's menu news. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Mei Li. You are with the menu on Monocle 24. Up next, we're off to Hong Kong. Nelson, too, is a newcomer to the hospitality industry. Born in Yangon but raised in Singapore, the 27-year-old entrepreneur saw a gap in Hong Kong's F&B scene and launched Club Rangoon, the city's first and only Burmese restaurant. He met up with Monocle's Karina Choi to discuss the mixed cultural influences behind Burmese cooking and how food has played an integral part in fueling revolution in Myanmar today.
To start with, I'm born in Burma, but I mostly grew up in Singapore and also spent a few years in Sydney and London as well. Moving around a lot also meant that I got to try a lot of food all over the world, and I'm really passionate about all the new and different culinary experiences. So I always thought that having that kind of love for it is key into like going into F&B as well. So you need to have that desire to deliver a really certain dining experience. And I felt that it was enough for me to deep dive into the industry and kind of pursue it for myself. Basically, I moved to Hong Kong in like 2018, just mainly to kind of pursue my master's in business management. I kind of took like a leap of faith after my studies here and kind of see how it would be opening up the first Burmese restaurant in Hong Kong.
To those who are unfamiliar with Burmese food, how would you describe it? Can you name a few dishes that are popular in Club Rangoon's menu?
I'd say like Burmese food is just full of character, so it's really, really hard to like sum it up. The cuisine just have influences from like neighboring countries like Thailand, India, China, and you can have like basically anything from like spicy, tangy, sweet, bitter. It's all in there for Burmese cuisine. Obviously, like Myanmar is such a huge country, so different parts of country has different distinct dishes that they do and different flavors as well. But the cuisine overall, I would say, is quite savory. So even a lot of our desserts tend to be, you know, some sort of like savory element to it as well. One of the dishes that we do at Club Rangoon would be the lapeto. That's our tea leaf salad, fermented tea leaf salad. So in Burma, we actually eat the tea as well instead of just drinking it. So it's a very, very unique dish. You know, we toss it in with like some tomatoes, some cabbages, and it's very, very light, very, very refreshing. And it's a great way to start off the meal as well.
You mentioned just now that because Burma is so huge, the food is different depending on the region or depending on the area. Can you sort of talk a little bit about what is so characteristically different about food from different areas in Burma?
Sure. Like I said, right, like Burmese food is influenced by Thai, Indian, Chinese. So let's take mohinga, for example. That's our national dish. So if you're having mohinga in Yangon, and if you go to like a state that's closer to Thailand, you might have a different variation of mohinga that's closer to more Thai flavors, meaning it's a little bit more sour, maybe a little bit spicier. So like different regions would have different renditions of how we would have our own national dish.
Like many other places in Asia, food is an integral part of Burmese culture. Can you speak a little bit on that?
I always feel that food always says a lot about culture as well, like, you know, starting from the way that it's prepared, the way that it's consumed, like, and the customs surrounding it. Like with Burmese cuisine, I think it's really important to pay attention to the flavors themselves and the way you kind of consume a traditional meal. For example, like you're not just eating like a piece of cooked chicken. You're eating that chicken with the rice with a little bit of balachan or ngapi, like it's a little radish on the side. You know, something like that. And then, you know, one is fried, one is crispy. So it's all about all these ingredients coming together. And the way that people eat together, I feel like the communality comes naturally. Everyone sits around the table sharing everything. You know, in Burmese culture, giving and sharing food is the norm. Let's say if it's a national holiday, neighbors usually kind of like exchange whatever they cooked on the day. National holidays literally means going around your neighborhood delivering food to family or friends or donating food and things like that. So that is a really, really like a strong approach to community when it comes to Burmese culture and the society. And I feel like Burmese food is the vehicle for it.
And do you think that there is a relationship between food and political activism in Burma?
Food has always kind of been political as well. So there's always an underlying relationship to the activism. Even where like certain dishes, certain foods, certain ingredients, they have become rooted to like their own histories, right? So in international relations or like trade routes and politics of food production and geographies. Yeah, but if anything, the current situation going on in Burma has kind of drawn a clear relationship between food and activism. So you need it for survival, right? It's during these times, like you see so many restaurants in Burma, if there's people like going out and protesting, just giving out free food, like handing out drinks, because the weather is really hot. People are there. It's not for any type of like marketing or getting it out there, but it's just giving out things for free. It's kind of like a mutual aid with food. It's at a core of this movement and everyone kind of relying on each other. So these acts of cooking, sharing, distributing during like a revolution like this, food kind of paves the way for political activism.
You know, visitors coming into your restaurant in recent weeks will receive a separate menu, aside from the food menu. And this is a special menu that's a call for peace. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so we've launched a new menu that the visitors will get alongside our regular a la carte menu for dinner. So in light of the recent events in Myanmar, we want to make sure that our diners are also fully aware of what's been happening. So the menu is the result of our efforts in informing the public and our visitors about what's happening in Burma day to day, and also like the historical context of the current political landscape. So this menu follows the format of the regular menu, basically, but each section, instead of the dishes, it has different aspects of what's been going on, ending with listing on how people can help, whether it be a petition or how they can support in terms of funding. And petitions are listed at the end and people can contribute their signatures to different campaigns or letters to governing bodies as well, yeah.
Do you think this has been successful or effective in getting people educated on the situation in Myanmar? And what have sort of your guests said to you in response?
I mean, overall, for us, it's more like if we put this menu out, not everyone will care, you know. But as long as there's some people who are interested, they have a little bit of knowledge about Burma and they want to know a little bit more, I think it's good for us to take that initiative as the only Burmese restaurant in Hong Kong as well. Yeah, definitely we do. A lot of people are interested and have been signing online or giving us their signatures. And some people have a lot of questions. And me being there personally during service, it's a lot more personal that I'm there and explaining to them as well. And yeah, a lot of people have a deep interest in what's going on in Burma.
That was Nelson Tu speaking to Monocle's Karina Choi. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. For previous episodes of this program, go to Monocle's website, SoundCloud or Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe to the show so that it automatically arrives onto your device every week. Also, do check out our menu spin-off show, Food Neighborhoods, for great recipes. This show was researched by Charlie Phil McCourt and edited and mixed by David Stevens. I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation, this time from Germany. Here is Bruckner with Für immer hier. Thanks for listening.